This episode is made possible thanks to listeners like you. Want to support independent food radio? Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate today.
Hello and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, career changers, and world changers. Today we're operating on a larger scale. We've had a lot of people on the podcast. Well, actually, let me step back. I'm your co-host, Ethan Frisch.
And I'm your co-host, Valerie Lomas.
And today we're working on a larger scale. We've had a lot of people on who have businesses like mine that are like, 2 years old and have not really accomplished anything. And so it's really an honor to get to talk to Beth Linsky, who had a company called Beth's Farm Kitchen. She was a jam maker for 36 years. Is that right?
Yep, that's it.
And is now a board member of the Fulton Stall Market and has done lots of other incredible things that we'll touch on. Beth, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here. It's fun.
so give us a little sort of introduction. Where do you start telling the story of your varied career?
My varied, varied, varied career. I think I should, could probably start pretty young, because since I ended up in food, so I started in food, because my very first real job was as a short order cook in a cafe, a coffee shop at a hospital.
Frying eggs?
No, it was mostly bacon that I remember. And making brownies. That's what they... Bacon and brownies.
Before anybody was making making desserts with bacon.
With bacon.
You were ahead of the curve.
I don't think they meant me to do that, but I was only 16, so what did I know?
And what drew you to food? Why was that something that you were interested in?
I have no really good idea, excepting that we've talked about this a lot as I've gotten older, is maybe because my mother was such a terrible cook when I was growing up, and then she got better at it, but we had to suffer through a few years of those pot roasts were just terrible. They were just horrible.
But she got better, right?
She did get better. Yep, thanks to TV and Julia Childs and a few of the other TV people, she learned how to cook.
Awesome. You kind of continued your education in the culinary field in a way by majoring in college.
Purely by accident. That was purely by accident. I have no idea. I mean, I would have wanted to go to France with their junior year abroad. Why didn't I sign up for those right classes so I could have taken them? I don't know. But anyway, I was a home ec major. That's what we called it in those days. There's other names for it now. But home ec major is what it was. But it wasn't specific because I learned how to sew and merchandise, but I also learned how to cook. And I remember this one class where we had to cook a tongue. It was just
a
the
tongue of
most
a cow?
The tongue of a cow.
How big was it? Do
awful.
You remember?
It was awful. I mean, it's like the fish. It's like the fish you caught.
The more you tell
bigger.
The story, the bigger. How did you cook the tongue?
Oh, I'm sure you just stewed it, but it's just terrible. I can't imagine.
Were there dishes that you remember learning to cook in college that have stuck with you? Or
no.
No.
Was it just a different time? Were you making the Jell-O salad?
Probably. I can't actually remember how much we cooked because I was also doing the dining hall stuff. And actually, you must have cooked because a lot of people were excited that on Thursday afternoon when we would come back out of our class, which was a cook class, and we would go back to the dorm and we would bring all the food in, and then we would have to, the we being the others who were servers, we'd have to race downstairs and eat the food for the that the college had. But this is all of our roommates and stuff got to eat the good stuff. They were very happy.
It sounds pretty classic. The people working at the restaurant don't get to eat the good food. That all goes to the
Did you experience that, Ethan,
guests.
When you were a line cook?
Oh, all the time.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure you did.
Sometimes I would swipe some foie gras or something.
Oh.
A little extra.
Naughty.
It's got to go on the plate in a certain way. And there's a little piece that doesn't make it onto the plate.
Okay.
It's got to go somewhere. You can't throw it away.
Well, you don't throw it away. That's
right,
food waste.
Exactly.
We don't do that.
Don't do that
exactly
anymore.
so then, Beth, tell us about your first couple of jobs out of college.
Out of college, I started as a stylist at a photographic studio, doing Montgomery Ward and Sears Roebuck children's clothes, and you know, they're children. This is children that we're mm-hmm. getting into those hard, even hard pajamas. The pajamas were so pressed and so, you know, permanently pressed. It was just incredible.
They were very starched.
Oh my God, they were terrible.
Was this for the catalog?
It was for the catalog, yeah. And they were, you know, and the kids had to stand so still and all this. So there was a lot of screaming and crying and stuff like that. So I was never going to be a preschool teacher ever.
So you stuck with that job until...
Not very long.
Okay.
And then I went on to Sears Roebuck and Company.
Okay.
I went, you know, right out of the fire into the pan. And I was there for 18 years.
Oh, wow.
And it was... I ended up being a buyer of large women's tank tops. Mm-hmm. And I'm just always so amazed when I think about you have so much responsibility, but it's such a small, tiny bit. You know, I know the company has failed, but it doesn't mean that we didn't do a lot of stuff during that time. You know,
oh,
it was
yeah,
just amazing.
Absolutely.
And the president of the company had been my patrol boy on my corner when I went to school. It was so funny to see him as a president. I mean, that was just odd.
How did you wind up dealing with large women's tank tops?
It just happened. It wasn't a choice. A lot of things in my life weren't really choices. They sort of would fall in my lap. That wasn't exactly one of the fanciest parts of the to be given, you know? It was like the lowliest part to be given of that department.
Yeah, but I mean, 18 years, that's quite...
Oh,
that's quite
long.
An accomplishment. So,
well,
so.
But I come from a generation of people who stayed in their job. You know, there was just, you were going to get a pension. But let me tell you about that. That is not the case. I got $114 a month for the rest of my life. That's my pension.
Congratulations.
I'm like, that's better than pretty much anything else
don't
I've
spend
heard
it all
lately.
In one place, yeah. So
how did you kind of transition out of Sears? And what did you do next?
Well, see, Sears decided to move back to Chicago. So then I was going to be a consultant, but that didn't work out. I couldn't do it. So I started catering. And that was only because a friend of mine, I did a lot of catering. I did a lot of dinner parties and stuff in my apartments in New York and all that. So, but my friend called me, Kathy Hunt called me one day and said, do you think you could do this favor for me? Could you make this dinner so-and-so's caterer just failed him? So could you step in and do this? I know you've never done it before, but I'm sure you can. Blah, 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 blah. So I did, and that started me on that catering. And we did corporate catering. I got a partner eventually, and we did a really great job. All we did was corporate. Mm-hmm. We never did anything for bar mitzvahs or showers or anything. We just did corporate. And it was fun. It was great. And then the tax laws changed. And that's when I had to sort of transition. But
so how did that affect you, the tax laws changing?
Well, because they weren't going to pay for what we call the three martini lunch.
So it was corporations kind of scaling back on...
They had to pull back.
On actually having
caterers. Yeah, because we used to go lunches. There in the morning and serve, you know, coffee, and then we would serve a breakfast, and then we would serve a nice lunch, and then we would serve tea in the afternoon, and then dinner and cocktails and da 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 da. So it was pretty expensive. We didn't charge a lot, but that's probably how we got our jobs. Because we weren't charging a lot. It was a totally different time in New York, too. You had a lot of caterers who were like me who didn't have all the credentials. And we didn't have all the backup kitchens.
Running it all out of your apartment? Is that how it worked?
Oh, yeah.
Or did you, for the whole time you had the business?
Yep.
Was that an issue? I mean, now it would be...
Now it would be a terrible issue. Oh, my goodness.
Was it an issue then?
No. Well, I suppose if the health department had known about it, but no, there wasn't that kind of, people weren't, you know, involved. Well, also people weren't involved with food that much.
Yeah.
And also that's when I started going to the green market to buy beautiful vegetables, to make things look beautiful. And that's, Martha Stewart was also around that time. All her books were coming out. So that all tied in together, getting me to the green market, making it look beautiful. You know, la 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 la. It was really pretty. Everything was pretty.
What was the green market like in those days?
Well, I did go to Union Square. I never did go to the original place, which was under the 59th Street Bridge. So I must have started in 77, I guess. Must have been 77 or 78 going to the green market. And but it could have been later, 79 maybe. But at any rate, I went to the green market and I would buy the stuff. And it was just, I got to know everybody.
Mm-hmm. How big was it? What kinds of things were people selling? What was the vibe like?
I think the vibe was great. And to me, it was really a lot like it is now. The vibe is because there's still a lot of the old farmers there. And you still have the feeling of a community. And then, of course, I was in the green market then after that for 35 years. So I really think of it as a community. You know, 37 years, I guess. 37 years I made jam, and I was in the green market from the very beginning. And the reason I did go into making jam was because it's something I could do. And I had a house in the country, and I could use that house, and I could use the farms up there. I knew some of them already from shopping in the green market, and so I was able to just transition, and I stopped catering and made jam.
Yeah, and so I mean, I think you might be best known for your jam making and chutneys. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's a pretty fair statement because it took up, you know, a large portion of my lifespan.
Right, right.
So I was very, I had a lot of fun doing it.
So what was like the first jam or chutney that you made, or what was like the first hit? What was the first one that people were like, man, we can't get enough of it?
Oh, my first real failure, I'll tell you that.
Okay, that works.
Was strawberry. Strawberry jam, I could not get it to set. And I could not. The first strawberries I bought were from a store that's now called Westside Market. I'm not sure if it was called Westside Market then, but it was on 110th Street. I didn't buy local. I bought just to try it and see if I could make it. And then I ended up going to Samascott's Orchard. That's who I bought most of my stuff from because they were in Columbia County, no more than 3 miles away from our house. And I would pick the strawberries there and stuff. But the best jam ever is strawberry rhubarb. Mm. It's the best, absolutely the best. Not my favorite, but it's the best. It sold the best.
What is your favorite?
Apricot. And it's made with Red Jacket Orchard apricots. Absolutely. Every year they were practically perfect.
What did the audience at the green market think? When were there a lot of other jam vendors?
Oh, well, there were some more jam vendors. I was not the only one. I think there were at least five or six of us. And literally, they died off. I don't know exactly what happened to all of the jam makers, but I know Elizabeth Ryan stopped making jam. But she makes everything else.
Donuts and cider.
and pasta and egg. I mean, she makes everything else, but she stopped making jams.
But you kind of stuck with jam.
I stuck with it, and I ended up being the main jam maker in the market. And then there's one other who's there, and now there's another one. So I'm sure there will be more.
So can you tell us a little bit about the green market from a vendor's perspective? I think most people have experienced it. If they have experienced it, it's been as a shopper. So what's it like to be on the other side of the table?
Well, I have a great deal of respect for the green market. Because they really gave people a chance to do things. So I'm sincerely appreciative of them. I'm getting teary with talking about it. But lots of things that I could have been in so much trouble for, they didn't allow that to happen. You know, they somehow smooched over it. Because I didn't follow all the rules because I didn't know all the rules. And that was something that I did later after the first 10 or 15 years of working in the green market. I got involved with this thing called small-scale food processors, and we started training people, so telling them what they had to do in order to start a business. I didn't know any of that stuff before. So that was really great that we got that going. And it's still going, but it's not as active as it was. Mm-hmm. But I still am working with the Green Market. I'm more than happy to be on the Rules Committee, which I know sounds so like I'm rigid and stuff like that. But I just think that we need to have rules and they have to be followed. And if you're working in that big a community, you can't have haphazard things, because one really serious incident will affect the whole of the community, in the Green Market community. It will spread just bad things. And we don't want that. That's not the way it's supposed to go.
So how is it supposed to go? What's sort of the ideal Green Market for
well,
you?
Well, it's probably will never go exactly, because it'll always be... I've been on the FCAC, which is a advisory board, Farmers and Community Advisory Board. And I've been on that for a number of years. I'm not on it anymore, but I'm emeritus now, so I can go to all the meetings. But you need to have the rules, and I believe in that. But then there's always the other side. You need to have the people who are on that board have to be able to talk to the farmers and to be able to sort of help the Green Market get their rules and their perspective, because the Green Market is doing a lot of different things. They're not just at Union Square. You know, they also have Green Market and Co., and they have the Grains Project, and they have all these other things. So it's not just these farmers at the market. You know, and Union Square isn't the only market. That's the other thing. They're getting much better at diversification right. than they were. So, you know, I think they're great.
Tell us a little bit about the process of starting the jam company, leaving catering, and then I don't know, what was it like to scale up a business like that? How did you figure out recipes and flavors? And
I actually did a lot of research, because the interim time where I was catering, from the time I left Sears and I was catering, and then we had the house in the country and I was thinking of doing the jam, I started going to the New York Public Library, and it was I learned a lot of the history of jam making, and also I learned a lot about chutneys, and I decided that I had to start with chutneys as well as jam, because if I only made jam, I would be so bored, because jam is so cut and dried. You decide what percentage of sugar you want, what percentage of fruit you want, and how it's going to be held together. Like, some fruits don't need any pectin, and some fruits have to have pectin, and so you decide those things, and then that's done. But chutney is a little more creative, you know, get the feel of things. And I also did savories and stuff like that.
So what were some of your chutney flavors?
Oh, well, Blazing Tomato was like our top seller, and that was fun, because that's from the old, it would be called a ketchup if it wasn't called a chutney, because it's made with all of the fruits of the harvest, and it's tomatoes and apples, and you know, so it's and vinegar and peppers, and it's got all those elements in it, and it would have been ketchup. And ketchup, I always had fun explaining that. The market, being at the market was always fun too, because you got to explain everything. And one of the rules in Green Market was the farmer had to be there. It's now not always honored, and you had to be there only once a month. And sometimes, well, maybe I can't, I'm doing 32 markets, so how can I possibly be there once a month? But anyway, I was there a lot. And I love talking to the people and telling them what I had learned from reading all that stuff in the library and I could remember things then. That was great. So,
what was it like developing those relationships with your customers? How did your business change as a result of those conversations?
I had lots of fun talking to people. As you can probably tell, I don't mind talking. And I just like talking to them. I loved getting all their feedback. We used to bring in samples of chutneys that we couldn't decide what spices to put into them, and we would bring a whole slew of them and then ask people to choose and do the, you know, because the markets weren't so busy in the very beginning. You know, they weren't that crazy press of people as they are now. Lots of times. And also, I did Wednesdays and Fridays, so those are not as busy days, so you could get people's opinions. And I just love talking to the people. And I still meet people at, you know, any place in New York. And you know,
I mean, so I'm looking at your book right now, The Cooking with Jams and Chutneys, Recipes from Beth's Farm Kitchen. And as someone who bakes and who deals with a lot of like fruit and sweet things, I'm just curious, could you give maybe like a novice person who is interested in like making some jam or chutney, like what are just like maybe some really big things that you've learned, not just from like when you, you know, were reading books at the library, but over your decades of experience?
Oh, well, don't ever buy junky fruit.
Okay.
Buy really good fruit. You know, yes, it costs money. You know, if something is past its prime, it probably doesn't taste as good. Even if you're cooking it, it doesn't taste as good. There's, we used to buy what was called processing grade, and that was very good if it was from a good farmer. Mm. Red Jacket had a lot of that, and we really liked that from them.
Where's Red Jacket?
Red Jacket's all the way in Geneva.
Okay.
But they don't really press, I don't think they're doing fruit anymore. I mean, I think they still have their trees, but I think that they're all into juice now.
Got it.
I think that's what their mainstay, but I used them for years. In fact, that was another thing we didn't mention, but how does a woman finance a business back in 1981?
Great. That is a great question.
So tell us.
Please.
Well, you don't finance it. You finance it off the back of the farmer, actually, and it was terrible, but I used to get my fruit from the farm, from the farmers, and then I would take out a loan at the beginning of strawberry season, and then I would pay off everybody, and then I would, then December would come along, and I would pay off everybody again, but I would constantly be in debt. I mean, I couldn't pay anybody the money that they needed, because my December was my, you know, November, December was my big time, and I had to, it was horrific, but the farmers were very gentle with me. But I couldn't get loans. You know, it was really difficult. And when I did get a loan, it was just a small loan. So the banks didn't want to loan money to women in those days. In the, I bet it was even till the 90s. And I couldn't get anything with a farm because the Farm Bureau, even though I had farm in my name, mm-hmm. I didn't grow anything. So it took until, oh, probably 2002, before Hudson Valley Economic Development Corporation realized that Beth's Farm Kitchen was helping farmers. I was helping the economic development of the farmers in Columbia County because I was buying from them, you know.
And decent quantities, right?
Oh, yes.
What were your big batches of jam like towards?
The big batch, the jam was never in big batches. Okay. It's always jars of 12 to 14.
Okay.
And so we would have 24 batches on the stove at the same time.
Oh, wow.
You know, it was a great kitchen, but, you know, not the best equipment. But the women who are still making jam in that kitchen are still working on the same stoves. Oh, do they wish there was new stoves.
24 burners?
I think it's only, they would do 24 batches in a day. So it's probably 14 burners.
And why was this?
Used for jamming. And the other burners are used for canning.
Okay.
Because they still can them the same way by putting them into pots and pulling them out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's great. It's old-fashioned. But it's pure.
Well, let's talk a little bit. I want to come back to that, but I also want to talk a little more about the financing of the business. That how did you get through that cycle of debt and repayment and debt and repayment? Did you get to a point?
I finally mortgaged my house.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Classic, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm borrowed money from my parents. You know, that kind of stuff. I mean, I really never got into any of this. You know, getting grants or getting until much later. I mean, it's really for the last maybe 10 years, we got some money from economic development. Mm. But before that, it was just always, you know,
bootstrapping.
Tight.
How did you handle the stress of that? Or maybe it didn't affect you? What did that feel like?
Let's see. Was there stress? I guess there was. But life was pretty stressful anyway, so I didn't have it too. I thought it was pretty easy because I would get, you know, up and I would make the jam. I didn't always make the jam. I stopped making it for a long time. And then because the kitchen crowd was so good, I didn't have to make it. So I was mostly in distribution. So that was one of the ways that I could handle stress is I would drive. So I put on 30,000 miles a year delivering jam. Wow. At the end, that's what I was doing.
In a truck? In
a little in van. We had a lot of jam. In van.
Snacking while you drove, a little spoon in a jar.
And also we sold fruit. We sold fruit to people like People's Pops and Brooklyn Soda Works and stuff like that. So I would be delivering to the Pfizer building with all these buckets of frozen fruit, you know. It was pretty much fun.
Do you have recommendations for someone looking to finance a small food business today? What would you do differently if you were starting your business today?
Oh, well, I would start with some money, first of all, but yes. I didn't have that. So, but, I mean, you just have to decide whether you want to do the business or not. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have a small business.
A very small business.
Yeah. Well, mine ended up being pretty big, but still not big. I mean, it wasn't big. And I was really glad to sell it. That was, you know, quite a bonus for me because I had planned on stopping the business because I wanted to be finished by a certain date. And so I had looked forward in that way. I'd stopped buying fruit and stuff like that. So we were going to be able to finish on a high note through that last Christmas season and then slide into April and be finished. Fortunately for me, it didn't happen, but that's, you know, I was going to have enough money to pay my debts, and that was going to be great.
But now it's even better.
Yeah. I paid them all off, and it was fun. And I got to do a little traveling on the side.
How does it feel to see your... Because it's still under your...
It's
under
still my name. They have my name.
So how does that feel to see somebody else running
it's,
the business?
It's okay. They're very nice people. I still am connected to it. You know, you can't walk away from it. I'm very happy to hear one of their most recent things that I heard that they were selling to... I think it's called Van Leeuwen's Ice Cream
yes,
Company.
Very popular.
And they have a lemon curd swirl ice cream, and it's our lemon curd. Wow. I see. I still say our. We made it. We know how to make it.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
I'm gonna have to check it out next time I'm there for ice cream.
Yeah, try it. The lemon curd is delicious.
We're gonna take a quick break. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. Stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by you. As an independent member-supported nonprofit, the amazing content you hear on HRN is made possible thanks to our generous community of members and partners. For 10 years, HRN has been a defining voice in America's food movement, and we never would have made it this far without you. Join us in celebrating an amazing decade of food radio and support our summer fun drive by becoming a member of HRN. You can choose from our member gifts and will receive exclusive discounts on HRN events. We truly believe that with your help, we can change the world and our food system one bite or sound bite at a time. But there's no food radio without you. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate before July 31st to do your part to ensure a bright future for your favorite food podcasts.
And we're back. You're listening to Why Food, and we're joined this week by Beth Linsky, who's a former jam maker, current board member of the Fulton Stall Market, and all around very knowledgeable, wise person on all things food in New York City and local food systems and farming practices. And I think that's where we were going to take the conversation next, right? Valerie, you want to?
Yeah, I mean, so I mean, you've kind of touched on the importance of like the quality of the ingredients, and obviously that kind of goes back to the farmers and the farms. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about that? Because I know you have a lot of work that you've done in the slow food movement. Do you maybe want to talk a little bit about that?
I'm not as slow foodie as I now as I was many years ago when it first started here in the United States, but we had this huge opportunity to go to the, I think it's called the Convivium, that's in Turin, Italy. We got to meet Carlo Petrini here in the States, one of our, you know, co-farmers, Don Lewis, who's now not in the green market anymore, but he does grains, and he got to know Carlo Petrini, and so we got to meet him and all this, and so we got to, I mean, I just love the whole idea of having food that's called slow food. People laugh about it. I know.
Well, what does it mean to you? What does slow food mean?
To me, it's that it's grown in a very responsible way. And it doesn't, to me, it doesn't have to be organic, because there are many people that I know who are farmers who think that you should be able to grow. In fact, they think that their growing practices are better than what has happened to the organic practices, because the organic practices are now, in order to be organic, they've dumbed it down a little bit. The rules are dumbed down a bit. Corporations can, you have to be, I want people to be sincere about the way they're growing, and they should honor the land. And we talked to these people just last night at this pig thing that we were doing last night at Fulton Stall Market, pig butchering by Fat Apple Farm, and they were talking about the pigs use their snout to cultivate the ground. I never knew that. I just didn't know that. But they were really talking about how they were changing this 400 acres into, you know, good, viable land, and using the pigs as tools. I mean, the pigs are being beautifully raised, but they are tools, and people obviously are respecting the land, and it's great that they do.
Why is that important to you? Maybe this is a stupid question, but what?
No, it's important because what are we going to do with all these people and no food in the world? You know, that's pretty hard, harsh. I mean, it's going to be hard. It's harsh right now. It's terribly harsh because of all the prejudices and racism that's going on. But how are we going to feed all the people who are going to be needing food? And they're not going to be, I just don't understand how we'll do it. But we can't do it if we kill the land. You know, you just can't do it if you kill the land.
But looking at a literal and figurative ecosystem like New York City, where it's not really feasible to eat locally 365 days of the year, whether it's an affordability question or purely a climate question. And you know, we all like to drink coffee and eat chocolate and you know, enjoy food that can't be grown.
Can't be local. I mean, we can't have local coffee.
Right. So I don't know. How do you see all of those elements of this puzzle fitting together?
I don't know. We still can't buy local toilet paper either. So, you know, it's hard. This is a hard issue. But we can try in our little way. We are a small portion of what is this big universe. And we can always try to be a little more responsible. I don't know. I mean, I know I'm not always responsible, but at least make an effort. You know, do a little bit every day.
Right. And I mean, what you were saying, Ethan, about, you know, we're in New York City, where are we going to get local food from? I think you were mentioning Brooklyn, apparently.
Brooklyn was a farming community.
One of the largest. Apparently.
The largest. In fact, it used to supply the food for the. It's so amazing that this was true. It was. I took a class about New York, and this was true. Brooklyn and Queens were the two biggest farming districts in the United States, because the plains hadn't been opened yet. You know, there was everything came out of New York to go towards the West. And the coffee, even, Uban Coffee, which was in Brooklyn, I believe it was in Williamsburg, that was the coffee that the cowboys drank when they were out on the plains. I mean, this is just amazing that the New York really was such a a farming place. In the 1920s, there were still farms out in Queens and out in Brooklyn. I can't believe it, but it was there. And also, oh, well, anyway, go on.
Right. I'm just saying, like, obviously, currently, it's a very different landscape.
Different, completely. But isn't it odd that we have so many farms on top of roofs now and stuff like that, which you would never think that that would happen.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's like the coolest thing whenever I'm at like a friend's fancy rooftop and you're looking down and you actually see greenhouses on top of buildings. It's like amazing because it's kind of like, well, we're using what we have. And, you know, I think that was the point you're making. It's like if we can all just maybe do a little something and innovation will hopefully.
And also people will start to understand that they have to be responsible about what they eat. I mean, having fancy beef isn't the be-all, end-all. Get some really responsibly grown beef or pork and don't have so much of it. You know, pay attention.
So how do you convince people to do that? Ooh. Or how do you get that message across?
It's a lot of talking for a lot of years. I'm not sure how you get it across. But you keep telling people. I mean, I was involved with the green market for so many years, and still some of my friends don't have any idea of what the green market stands for. And they've never been to a farmer's market. They'll buy jam from me and give it to all their friends for Christmas, but they don't have any idea of why I do local. You want to wring their necks, but anyway.
Well, I mean, are there strategies that you've found that are effective in getting that message across, or ways that, other than standing at the table at the green market, which is fun, but you're preaching to a choir, right?
I'm preaching to a choir.
So how have you found ways to reach beyond that sort of first circle of people who are already on board?
The only thing that I have been able to do in my little world is just to continue to be involved with the green market and with like the Fulton Stall Market. That's all of it is going towards farmers. Whereas Fulton Straw Market is like on a consignment basis. So they the farmer and the vendors, which are the small vendors in New York, which are making stuff in the incubators around New York. There's only about four or five of them now. Those people are in ours. And they get 82% of what we sell it for back. So it's really kind of interesting. They're at least making some money. It's hard to, you know, farmers have to stay in business. We've got to pay more for our food. But you can do that. You can pay more for your food, but you just have to eat less of it.
Mm. Right.
I'm going to spring a question on you, and maybe this isn't relevant, but I just saw there was yesterday, Andrew Cuomo, the governor, signed a new farm bill into law. Have you heard about this?
I hope it says 60 hours.
So 60 hours.
Good.
So
anyway. Good.
Do you want to give us a little introduction, or should people go and read about it for themselves?
I think they should go and read about it. I don't know if all the farmers are really pleased about it, but I know that for in the beginning they were talking 40 hours.
Yeah. Can we get a snippet? Because I'm a little.
Oh yeah. So there's
just
been
a little hint.
There's been a farm bill in process for, I think it's been on and off for several years.
Oh yeah.
But in the last few months, it's sort of come to a head. Labor protections for farm workers, which is not really something I think that's ever been protected by law before.
No, it hasn't.
And one of the particularly controversial points in this farm bill was the number of hours that a farm worker needs to work per week before they get overtime pay. And controversial because farming is so seasonal, especially in New York State. That you have weeks where you're working a lot and then a lot of weeks in the winter where you're not really working at all or not working kind of at the same level in any case. So the number of hours, 40 hours or 60 hours before the overtime pay kicked in.
Well, 40 hours was just absolutely nothing because a farmer works much, 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 much longer.
Yeah.
I mean, 60 hours still, a farm worker really works so long. It's just amazing. And we used to have... We had all of our fruit that we put into buckets, you know, and the Semascots, their workers would do our fruit. They would cut up the peaches and stuff after they had worked all day. And then they would come into the barn and cut up the fruit and put it in the buckets to freeze it. I mean, it was just amazing the hours that they put in. But they know that they have to get their all their money in this period because the Northeast doesn't have a very long season.
Yeah.
And, you know, these poor people, they work like crazy.
Are so, these farm workers, is it a lot of immigrants or... So is this kind of like a multifaceted issue or
it's a multifaceted issue.
Got it.
Some of them are there every year. Some go back to Mexico or wherever and then get back in, but it's harder and harder to do that. And I mean, you know, there are years when nobody got back in or the paperwork hadn't been done right and they didn't. And then there's the H-2A workers, which I don't know too much about, but I know some farmers use them. And they're mostly, I think, from Jamaica. Now, I'm not sure. But I'm not the one to talk to about it, but I've heard a lot.
Right.
Yeah, it was a pretty controversial piece of legislation. A lot of farmers are pretty unhappy about it. Margins are so slim for New York State farmer.
And this, they already have to pay for lodging, you know, and the car getting people back and forth to the grocery store and stuff like that. I mean, the farmers already pay for that, and they already pay for meals for farmers, for workers. It's hard. Everything's going to cost more.
Yeah, I would recommend to our listeners either look this up and read about it, but also next time you're at the Green Market, ask the farmer or whoever it is behind the table what
Great
they think
point.
Of it. It's definitely a controversial issue and sort of a wedge between city perspectives on farming and farm workers and country perspectives.
And the point you made about actually if we want good food and good food might mean like caring about the land and also caring about the workers, like as a whole.
We do have to care about the workers.
Right. We're going to have to
it's
pay
serious,
for it.
It's a serious
guessing.
Problem.
Yeah. All right. Well, in the last few minutes of our conversation, we always do our fun rapid fire segment. So here we go. You want to start or should I start?
Yeah. Okay. Talking about farms, what is your favorite vegetable? To eat.
To look at,
maybe it's eggplant.
Okay.
To eat is probably asparagus. But it's not that I ever grew them or anything. I just, they always went with soft-shell crabs so well. I don't know. They were beautiful, you know, and I thought they always had to be served long and thin. And that's, you know, I finally learned that I could chop them up. I think it was just such a funny thing to all of a sudden say, oh, yeah, I could chop this. Yeah, I don't have to put them down the middle of the plate. Okay.
What did you eat for breakfast growing up?
Cream of wheat with lumps in it.
Lumps?
Lumps.
Did you enjoy the lumps?
No, I didn't. That's why I remember it so well.
Who made the cream of wheat?
Mom.
a big pot for the whole
big
family.
Pot for the whole family. You know, slop it out. It was, you know, but we had a nice, and there was a Don McNeil's Breakfast Club, and we used to march around the table to the tune of Don McNeil's marching around the table and out the door to school. Da-da-da-da.
Sounds very organized.
Militaristic, doesn't it?
She ran a tight...
a tight ship.
Yeah.
I'm going to steal one of Ethan's questions. If you could have any superpower, what would it be?
Oh.
And why?
I never thought of having any superpowers.
Other than jam making, which clearly was a superpower.
That was certainly a superpower. I think having a really good memory from my whole life would be a good superpower to obtain.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, as you get older, you really do start to forget things. And I do like to remember things. So how many crossword puzzles can you do?
we ask that question a lot, and the answer is usually logistical. It's usually about transportation. I wish I could teleport. I wish I could fly.
Oh.
But we're usually asking younger people that question. And I guess younger people are always in a rush to
a
get
rush
everything
to get there.
Done.
Sure
would you have said, what would you have answered when you were younger?
When I was younger, I might have wanted a bigger, taller van and had smooth ride because I did 30,000 miles a year. And it was, you know, now I even have a car that has no air conditioning, so I'm really going retro. I mean,
that's the best superpower I've ever heard anybody ask for is good shocks on your van. I love it. If you could, what's the best meal you've ever eaten that cost, say, under $5 or $10?
I probably, that's hard. You know, I've done a lot of traveling, so that's a tough one.
One of the best ones that
I've ever had, I think, was this ricotta cheesecake. I think it might be called casita in Sicily. It's served in breakfast, and it's so good. Really amazing. I think it might have cost under $5.
Hey, I love dessert for breakfast, so I am down for
okay,
that.
Okay, good.
Absolutely. Do you have time for another?
Yeah, sure.
What's your favorite kitchen utensil?
It's a paring knife.
Oh, that's
it's basically
one.
What it is. Mm-hmm. It has a blade. It's only about 5 inches long. That's my favorite. In the evening when we're getting ready to have dinner, I usually do the cooking. I just love that half an hour of chopping things, and that's a very zen time for me.
Do you want to leave us with any advice, thoughts, suggestions for people thinking about or in the early stages of starting their own food businesses? What would you recommend?
Well, make sure you're in a business where you like the product that you have. I mean, I really like jam, so it was easy to do that. And I really recommend that you like the people you work with. If somebody who's working with you is an irritant and you're the boss, get rid of them.
That's really great advice.
Pay them to leave.
Well, Beth, thank you so much for joining us this week. You have a cookbook that people can purchase, is that right? Getting in touch with you?
By getting in touch with me.
How would they do that?
At Beth Linsky, Linskey, @gmail.com.
And Valerie and I are both sitting here looking at this cookbook, and it's beautiful. And
well, we had a lot of fun making it. It was really great. It took a long time to make, and we did our own publishing, you know, because I lack patience in some things, and I couldn't put up with having to wait to have somebody approve this and have whatever, blah, 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 blah. So we got it all put together ourselves.
I love it. Any cookbook with a spiral bind, I'm in.
It's good. That's like the sign that legit. These are like real, like tried and true, like come from the heart kind of recipes.
That's great. Well, thank you for listening. We're coming up on the end of the Heritage Radio Pledge Drive. So if you haven't made a donation, if you haven't thought about making a donation, where have you been and what are you waiting for? There are some great prizes at different levels of donation. You can visit our website, heritageradionetwork.org, and click on the donate button, which I think is a beating heart. So it it feels good. And if you donate $500, if you're feeling generous or came into some money recently or whatever, you want to fork over $500 to support a nonprofit radio in Brooklyn, I will personally curate a set of 6 of our single origin spices for you from my company, Burlap and Barrel. And as always, you can reach us via our email, yfood@heritageradionetwork.org. We're on social media, YFood Podcast on Facebook and Instagram. You can find me via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel.
And you can find me on Instagram @foodieinnewyork.
Thanks for listening, and see you next week.
Okay, bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.